Welcome to the Time and Motion podcast with me, your host, Lee Stevens. For over 25 years, I've worked with businesses all over the world to improve the technology and the people within them. In this podcast, I share some of my experiences and I chat to guests who generously share their stories of how to, or in some cases, how not to, live a productive life. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to episode 11. Now, if you're like me, you're constantly striving and looking to improve yourself in every aspect of your life. For me, self-improvement's a journey with no real final destination. Today, we're surrounded by modern-day charlatans, however, who call themselves life coaches. In this week's episode, I catch up with James Lachlan. He's a 7-times world champion and a high-performance leadership coach. James's Lead on Purpose podcast is currently near the top of business and management charts in quite a few countries around the world. And so if you haven't done so already, go and check that out on Spotify or any platform that you go and listen to podcasts on. James dispels quite a few myths around coaching. He talks about the 7 things that high-performing leaders do consistently, and he details some daily habits that you can form to live a more productive life. So on with the show. James Lachlan, how are you?
Fantastic. All the better for seeing you.
Good afternoon.
Good to be here.
What have you been up to today?
Been a great day. I was up bright and early. I had a meeting in the city first thing. And then I had an incredible meeting with some of my leaders. I run a mastermind for leaders all over New Zealand. And we sat down with former All Black and serial entrepreneur Andy Ellis for the morning. Had a few coffees and yeah, great conversations.
Yeah, it was good. Thanks for the invite on that one, by the way.
So good to see you there.
Right. Okay. So James Lachlan, you are an executive coach. You've got many hats, I guess you wear, which is a common theme that we have with people on the show. Do you want to just start by saying what some of those hats are and what you do?
Yeah, thank you. So a few different things. Number one, as you said, I'm a high-performance leadership coach and executive coach with people who are running companies, people who are professional athletes. I'm actually working with a really interesting caddy right now. He's a caddy to a current number three world golf-ranked golfer. Very interesting for me. So oftenly, with that hat on, I learn as much from my clients as much as I support them. I also run an annual event, which is just coming up in Christchurch. Actually, it's the HPL, High Performance Leadership Program. So a lot of focus goes into that. I bring in some incredible speakers. Over the last few years, we've had Sir John Key, our former Prime Minister, Kieran Reid, former All Blacks captain, Steve Hansen, Ali Adams. We've had some brilliant speakers. So that's coming up in June. So that takes a big focus. And as I mentioned, I run a leadership mastermind. And so once a month, we've had Barack Obama's former senior advisor, CEO at Madison Square Garden. Today, obviously, we had Andy Ellis from the All Blacks. So once a month, we get together and brainstorm and ask great questions. And of course, I run a podcast called Lead on Purpose.
Yeah, number 2 in New Zealand, I see. Not quite number 1.
Not quite number 1. It's first loser for me. Yeah, so I'm quite competitive, mate. So I'm pushing for that number 1.
So it must be quite odd to be on the other side of the microphone in this occasion.
Can I be honest? It really is. I'm so used to being the interviewer.
I feel like I'm being watched. Okay, so before we hear a bit more about you and your story, I just want to explain to listeners where we met. So I don't know if you remember that. How did we meet, James?
So I'm going to go back up to the Northland, so north of Auckland. Caroline and I had a juicy camper van. We were traveling around camping. It was amazing. And you and I met.
Specifically.
This is way too much information, folks. We met in the shower room, little shower room in the morning. Lee was having a shave. I was having a shower at a campsite. And we got yarning. And little did we know, things would end up going this direction.
And then you moved into the neighborhood, right?
That's a bit of a crazy story.
Yeah, so this is probably the most New Zealand story you'll ever hear. So not only did I meet this cool guy in the shower room on the in a campsite, that same guy then goes and moves to top of my road.
Essentially next door in a very isolated part of Christchurch, yeah. Too, a very particular part. Yeah. And I was very worried about moving there because obviously my business is all online. So I Googled, what will the internet be like in Cass Bay? And all of a sudden it came up with this guy, Lee Stevens, Brighter Days, knows about internet in Cass Bay. So I text this Lee Stevens guy going, hey, I'm about to move to Mariner's Cove. So what's the deal? And then we realized that it was the same person.
Yeah, so welcome to New Zealand. That's how it works for our international listeners, right? That's just, yeah, it's 1 degree of separation, if that. So, James, really keen to understand a bit about you and your story. So where did you grow up?
So a long way from here, arguably you couldn't travel any further. It's 12,000 miles where I grew up. So Northern Ireland, small working class town called Ballyclare. And beautiful place, but very divided. And when I say that, for the listeners that don't know anything about Northern Ireland, it's divided with Protestants and Catholics, a religious divide. It's more so turned into a power struggle and drugs and all that. But growing up, I really noticed it. We lived in a Protestant village, and it was very clear that a lot of people that we went to school with and that we associated with, that they really had a dislike for Catholics. Now, when we were brought up, we didn't go to church. Mum and dad really taught us to respect everyone else for who they are and how they show up. But I remember as a young kid seeing young boys going down the street in wheelchairs, and they'd been kneecapped. So the local paramilitaries, whether it's in this case UVF, but some people might be more familiar with the IRA, they would shoot young men's knees as a punishment shooting for misbehavior. So from a young age, I felt very uncomfortable there. And me, myself, there was opportunity for me to go down some pretty dodgy paths. Sometimes I treaded down some of those paths as a young boy. And certainly, you know, there was a big pivotal moment. I'm sure we'll get to that. But there was something that happened in my life that really changed the trajectory for me. But Northern Ireland is a beautiful place. It'll always be home. My parents are still there, my siblings, niece, nephew, grandparents even. But I will say that Aotearoa, New Zealand, this is the place I love and I plan to be for here for a very long time.
And it's interesting explaining about the troubles to, or explaining the troubles to people that, as you say, live over here, probably never seen any degree of violence or, I suppose, yeah, just the troubles that go on in a community like that. So what sort of year are we talking there, James?
So I was born in 86, show my age now. So grew up there, late 80s, early 90s. And so we're looking at, certainly there were still bomb scares. There were bombs going off. There were punishment shootings. There was 12th of July, lots of activity going on then. I remember probably the day before I left Northern Ireland, looking out the window of the landing up at the top of the stairs. And all I could see were petrol bombs being thrown right outside our house at the police. I thought, Christ, I just want to get out of here in one piece. I want to get my residency and I want to move. So yeah, there was a part of Northern Ireland that really did scare me and made me very uncomfortable. Yeah, it's interesting reflecting back on that.
Yeah. I mean, and even in London where there were some quite big bombing campaigns and growing up, and I can always remember a conversation I had when I first came over here, and someone said, are you not scared about the earthquakes? Do you know what city you've come to? And I said, oh, well, you know, we've had 30 years of bombs and terrorism in London. You're trying, if something doesn't get you, the other thing will, right?
Pick your poison.
Yeah. So, yeah, but I think just very different childhoods that people would have had if you, yeah, London, and absolutely understandably, right? So what was you like at school?
So, very boisterous, very curious. I was definitely the student that was always like, why? But why? Can you explain that? Hey, no, I don't think that's right. Can you tell us why you're telling us that? Always asking, always kind of going deep. I'd say I was a glue guy. And what I mean by that, not the glue sniffer. I was always working between the groups. So the rugby guys, I was never into rugby, but I got on well with them. The geeks, as we called them, or maybe nowadays it's more appropriate to say the academics, people who really valued studying, I got on really well with them. The musicians, the recluses, I just spent time with people. And being the glue guy, what would happen is somebody, one of the jocks would want to pick on one of the geeks, and I'd be able to go in and navigate and say, hey, there's other things we could be doing and distract them. So I was always in the middle of different groups, probably never a strong part of any of those groups.
In-betweener,
there you go.
Yeah, I should make a TV program. Okay.
So I ended up at one point, there was one pivotal moment where a young boy was being bullied. And I went over and says, okay, to the bully, that enough's enough, mate. I was probably 8 or 9 years old. And it was spring, daffodils were up. I says, look, you need to cut it out. And kept bullying, kept punching and hitting. He says, look, you're going to have a daffodil sandwich if you don't stop. And he didn't stop. He ended up having a daffodil sandwich. I ended up in the headmaster's office, Mr. Pollock's office. And he said, boy, tell me the story. So I told him the story. He says, okay, you're not here often for bad behavior. You've got a decision to make right now. You've got a choice. A week of detention or a set of drumsticks. And I laughed. I said, are you punking me? Like, what's going on here? He said, no, If you can turn up for a whole term to a drum lesson on a Tuesday after school with Mr. Lee, we'll forget about this ever happened. Okay, deal's a deal. So that was the start of a new hobby. It got me focused on something really positive. Headmaster started to give me a lot of kudos. In my mind, I was going to be the next Ringo Starr. And I was like, yes, rock drumming. I might even get my first girlfriend. If I'm lucky, this is such a cool thing to do. Realized a few months in, it was actually pipe band drumming, Scottish drumming. So I'd have to wear a skirt, actually a kilt, but at that time I thought it was a skirt. So I wasn't quite sure, but I realized, Lee, and this is the key part for me, it's a competitive form of drumming. There's Irish championships, national, world, New Zealand. And I love the thought of really challenging myself and challenging others. And that really dictated a lot of where my life took.
So that was going to be one of my questions, you know, why drumming? Because at 14 or around 15, I did my research, you became a world champion.
Yeah, 13 years old, yeah. I was very fortunate. Yeah, that was quite surprising. I remember mum and dad going off to work. I had my school blazer on. I'd pretend I was going to school. I'd come back home once they'd left, take the blazer off, take the tie off, sit down and drum for 6 hours and skip school to practice drums. And I've only told my mum that recently. She wasn't very impressed.
Oh, well, if she's listening, I'm sure she'll sympathise.
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay, so you became a world champion, and I think the drumming was then a thing that you got pretty good at. So what was your journey from there on?
Yeah, again, probably those early mid-teens, pretty dynamic experience. Mum and dad went through a pretty tumultuous divorce. I started drinking with some older family members, gambling. It just wasn't very pretty. And I was going down a slippery slope. Phone call came in from Vancouver, Canada, 15, 16. Said, hey, Simon Fraser University here. We have a pipe band. And at that point, they had won the world championships. They were a brilliant band at the very top level. Would you like to come to Vancouver for 6 weeks? Fly you over. We'll find you a place to sleep. And then you can go back and play at the world championships with us in Scotland. Absolutely. I was on that plane. Within 2 weeks, I realized I don't want to be ever living in Northern Ireland. I want this life. This is a cool life. Vancouver's so multicultural and very positive, and there's a lot of optimism. So went to the World Championships with them 2004. Very fortunate that we won the World Championships there. And at that point, then I got a phone call from Christchurch, New Zealand. I had no idea where that was, Lee. And I said to my dad, New Zealand. He goes, oh yeah, Jonolumu, that's, you know, the All Blacks. So I started to paint the picture of the fern. And so that was a private school here. In Papua New, who had a pipe band program, and they said, look, can you come down and help us build a world-class program? We want to be the first Kiwis to win the world championships. So I negotiated a bit of a deal. I wanted to upgrade from a sofa, which was in Vancouver, to a bed. I wanted to actually get paid in money rather than beer tokens. And here's the deal breaker for me. If you guys want me to come down there, I want residency. Permanent residency, and for the reasons that you obviously know, to secure my future. And I got my end of the bargain. And in 2013, they got their end of the bargain. The St. Andrews College became the first world champions.
And how old was you at this point, James?
When I came to New Zealand? 19.
19. So still quite young.
Still a kid.
Yeah, finding your way. And then I saw on your website you had some other fairly monumental experiences in life, even from that point on. I think you've probably crammed more in your years than most do in a lifetime. So yeah, just talk us through what life was like in New Zealand from there on.
Yeah, I mean, there was lots of high highs and there were certainly some low lows. So again, in New Zealand, I was obviously teaching a program and building a program at St. Andrews. I was running a professional adult band as well called Canterbury Caledonian. Started my first business, which was a retail business. And my partner at the time, Lisa, came down from Canada to live here as well. So we're running the business together. And life was somewhat just trucking along and everything was fine. And then 2010, 2011, the Christchurch earthquakes hit. And I actually found it very difficult. And PTSD to me is something that people get when they go to war. They're in Iraq, they get, you know, potential PTSD. Little did I know that I was suffering with PTSD after the earthquakes. And every time a large truck would go by or a small earthquake would go, I would really feel that cortisol. So I was drinking quite a bit to kind of just numb the pain, reduce the stress, like I guess a lot of people do. So that was a big kind of, hey, what's life all about? A few years later, wanted to become a dad. and we had a miscarriage. And I'd always known about miscarriages, never really talked about it. And I figured it was an issue that would really impact the lady more than the man. And I could not believe how much that really shook me. And what that did, it forced me to really take stock of what's life about? What am I doing day to day? Does it actually matter? And so I went and got a little bit of NLP therapy, so neuro-linguistic programming, to deal with some of the PTSD and trauma. And that gave me an opportunity to go, do I want to keep doing this drumming thing? And yeah, it's going great and I'm enjoying it for the most part, but something's missing. And so I started searching for, well, what is missing?
Okay. So what did you do?
Yeah. So after that, Tony Robbins, some of the listeners will be familiar with Anthony Robbins from North America. Incredible business strategist, NLP guru, and essentially motivational speaker. Went to one of his events in Sydney. And this was along with Lisa, my former wife. And we had 4 or 5 days, 18-hour days, pushed you to exhaustion, walking across fire. It was a very interesting experience. But during that event, Lisa had a really pivotal moment where she left the event for half an hour, got on the phone, rang a family member in Canada and says, I'm coming home next week. I've got to come home and I've got to address something and I've got to forgive you. So she had some stuff happening in her childhood and she realized then she's got to go and take care of that, which I was very proud of her for. And for me personally, I had a moment where I said, okay, I've done everything I can do in the drumming world. I'm so fortunate to have won 7 world titles myself, helped a young band from New Zealand win a world championship, but I'm done. So what can I do with the skill set that I've amassed and what interests me? And I realized I get a kick from being around other people who are ambitious, other people who are high performers. I thought, if I can add value to those types of people, that's going to give me an incredible amount of fulfillment. And so I came back to New Zealand and within a year and a half, 2 years, I'd fully transitioned over as a coach, working with high performers in business and sport. And it's just gradually and organically built from there, really.
I'll come on to the coaching side in a moment, but that sounds like a pretty ballsy move. So how did you know that was the right thing to do?
That's a good question. Honestly, I battled with this for a long time, Lee. Look, when you're in a career, and drumming truly was a career for me, I was earning probably 10 times as much as I ever would have earned if I had stayed in Ireland. I was a waiter at a hotel there. There was no real ambition, no trajectory for growth. Look, I was earning great money. I was living in a really good community and things were tracking well, but success, and I guess people look at world championships or building teams, that's success, right? But success without fulfillment, ultimate failure. So to me, I was not fulfilled. And so I thought, okay, if I can park that career to the side and have a career that challenges me, that borderline scares me. So some of the clients that I work with, I get nervous before I work with them. I don't know where the conversation is going to go. I don't know what they're going to bring to the party. So to me, I wanted to always feel that edginess, that excitement. And so that helped me make it.
And that came up this morning, right, about the high performance. And I think this is something I definitely resonated with, was Andy was saying about how when he was playing rugby and at first, the first 2 years, he was just the nervous energy that he really had. And he said after what 2 years, he started craving it because he said, actually, that's when I perform. That's actually when I do my good stuff. And that's when I know I'm growing. And I absolutely, you know, was in tune with that, because for me, I'm the same. Like, you have to, and someone said, maybe you're narcissistic. but I guess it's like a similar journey for you, right? You kind of needed that nervous energy to do something. And as you say, you then sort of began your high performance leadership and coaching. So how do you get from pipe band drummer, world champion to leadership coach of the elite athletes that you are now?
Yeah, so I'll go back and I kind of unpack that transition. And there's probably a couple of things. I know, for me anyway, to learn what good leadership is, you've got to experience the opposite of that. And certainly I can go back and I can reflect on some really poor leaders I had. And I can reflect on some poor leadership that I showed, particularly in my early 20s, running teams of adults that were twice my age. Look back at my shortness with them, my short-sightedness, sometimes my overambition, which could, you know, turn it on its head. So that's certainly that experience. I learned a lot about what leadership isn't in my younger years. And I've spoke to someone recently who was in my team then, who was an adult. I said, oh, I'm sorry. Sometimes, you know, I maybe overreacted and was a bit intense and asked a bit much of you. And he said, no, I learned so much from you. I look back fondly on that. So it's funny because I have a filter of, ooh, I wouldn't want to be that leader ever again that I was then. But some of the people that were involved in it actually appreciated some of the outcomes. So when I got to the point of going, okay, to go from drumming to working with people in corporate settings or team settings, where's the value add? And so it came quite naturally from a parent. I'd been teaching their child drums for 5-6 years. They ran a business here, medium-sized business in Christchurch. Seeing what I'd done with the culture, high-performance culture within the team. And it's funny because I was a drumming tutor, but I would say 50-60% of what I was doing was storytelling, was motivating, we're dealing with mindset, giving them mental skills so that when they go to the world championships and they've got 4.5 minutes to perform, it's cost $250,000 to get them there. We want to make sure that they perform and they don't drop the stick or get nervous or have sweaty hands. Sweaty hands as a drummer is not a good thing. So I took those skills and this parent said, hey, could you come in and talk to my team? Talk to my team about what winning culture looks like and just tell them the story of what you did with the young students at St. Andrews. And so these conversations started happening. I built more confidence and I got more interested in doing that. That same person said, hey, is there any chance you could work with some of them one-to-one as well? And so it just started to organically build. I made a decision at the start. I wouldn't bring in some branding agent. I wouldn't pay for ads and marketing. I wouldn't lift the phone and do the hard sell to get people to buy coaching. I wanted things to be organic. And so there was that transition where I was still at St. Andrews and still doing my drum thing whilst building this business on the side. And so I just, word of mouth has been, I guess, the greatest way to build the brand.
So when we met in the campsite, we'll just leave it at that. You mentioned that you was an executive coach, I think that was the term you used. And I'll be completely honest, yeah? I just went, oh, he's another life coach. There's loads of them now. And I'll be honest, yeah, I'd used a couple episodes because I think every 5 years, I'm probably like a lot of people, I have to reinvent myself and go, well, what's next? And so that's probably more in me than anything. But yeah, use a couple of coaches. And for me, it just felt it was all quite fluffy and it was all like just regurgitated. I said, you regurgitated like Oprah quotes and and Tony Robbins quotes and exercises that have been found on the internet. So why do you think, and I think I probably answered that question already, but why do you think kind of coaching and life coaching gets such a bad rep?
Honestly, it's an industry that's like the Wild West. Anybody can say, I'm a coach and you're going to pay me and I'm going to give you all the answers. But I think if you're a listener right now and you're going, do I need a coach? I'm just going to say to you, look, when you go to look for a coach, spend some time getting to know them, do your research. And the first question you need to ask that coach is, who's your coach? And if they don't have a coach, they're not willing to tell you who their coach is. You don't want to work with someone like that.
So who's your coach?
I've got multiple coaches. Actually, I've got three. Yeah, and I love working with them. They challenge me. They push me.
What do you think some of the common myths are about coaching?
Interesting. So traditional coaching, if you go to the ICF, the International Coaching Federation, that is, you're not allowed to consult a client. You must only ask questions and the client must discover and uncover. So that's essentially what traditional coaching is. Look, I think high-performing leaders and people who are working under pressure with large teams, they do want to be asked really powerful questions, but also they need and rely on you as a leadership coach or an executive coach to give them the gems, the gold, the experience, the resources, the connections. So to me, I think people who want to go to a coach and be told what to do or have an accountability partner, you don't get a coach. Just ask one of your friends to hold you accountable. Coaching's a big investment financially and time-wise. It's huge. And with coaching, if you get the world's best coach and you're paying them $100,000 a year, but you don't show up and do the work and you don't do the reflections in between and take the action, you may as well not have a coach at all. You know, the fact that a lot of people say, I've got a coach, to me means nothing. It's like, okay, what are the results? What are you doing in between your sessions? That's where the gold is.
Yeah. And I think, like for me, you probably hit the nail on the head there about the answers coming from within, because when, you know, you and I sort of started working together, I'd made the realization, well, my board members, you know, advisory board members at the time had said, you know, who's your coach, Lee? I was like, oh, I haven't got one. You know, why do I need one of them? And he was like, you need a coach, right? So I thought, okay, let's open your eyes a little bit, open your ears, and we had that chat. And I think it was fairly obvious to me that the answers had to come from within. You wasn't going to give me the answers. And even now, like, I've got people saying, who's your guy? And I talk about you. And they're great. Is he going to tell me how to run my business and how to make me a millionaire? I was like, no, he's not going to do that. What he will do is ask you some good questions, and then you'll figure it out yourself. And I think that's probably one of the big myths about coaching, right? It's that kind of, it's the Rocky, you know, who's Mickey's on the side, like, and you got to do this, you've got to jab with the left, jab with the right. The reality is, Mickey be saying is, Rocky, how do you think you should be jabbing, right?
Totally. And I think when you look at mentoring people or growing teams, people in this generation, and probably of all generations, but this one of mostly, people don't want to be told how to do the thing. They want to know where we're going. They want to know the vision, but they want the autonomy to figure out how to get there and to draw on their skills and their creativity. And I think coaching, a good coach, will ask you a question and then shut up and let you go deep and let you uncover.
Okay. What do you think coaching isn't?
Coaching isn't a fix-all. Coaching isn't a shortcut. I had someone recently, a very successful business person, somebody I admire, been working with them for a year. Got to the end of the year and I said, okay, let's sit down, let's review, and let's chat. Do you want to continue? Do we want to part ways? What's going to be best for you? And we started talking. And he said, James, you know what I was expecting? About 2 months in, I was expecting this aha moment. I was expecting this multi-million dollar breakthrough. I was expecting this like world-changing moment. He says, that didn't come 2 months in. He's like, I'm a year in now. And I feel like truly we're starting to like figure out where the gold is. We haven't uncovered the gold, but I'm truly starting to understand who I am, what my identity is, why I do what I do, where my shortcomings are. And so that really reinforced to me that coaching's not short term. It's not a quick fix. ChatGPT can do that for you.
And now?
Yeah. It's a long-term investment.
And I think when we first started talking as well, I think there was a couple of things that I remember you saying. So the first one was not everyone can be coached. And yeah, so do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah. And I think there's certain times in one's life that you're more coachable than others. So being coached by my mum at 13 about how to be a human, I probably was quite uncoachable. Yet at 13, being coached by my drumming teacher, I was all ears. So I think there's different times in your life, and that goes into adulthood too. But when it comes to leadership and executive coaching, the person who's high, very high in ego, and we've all got ego, but very high, don't tell me what to do, don't know, don't want to be told, I've got all the answers, they shouldn't even look for a coach, because coaches are going to trigger them and they're probably not going to work very well with them. So some people want to improve. Some people have fixed mindset. Some people have growth mindset. The only people I will work with are people who show signs of a growth mindset, the ability to open up and be curious and accept that they haven't got all the answers.
Okay. Do you ever get that wrong? Do you ever make the wrong call and think, yeah, this guy I can coach, or guy or girl, I can coach them, and, you know, within two sessions, three sessions, you're like, this isn't going to work?
Absolutely. Yeah. Probably in the last 2 years, I've probably had, I'd say two occasions where I'm like, I'm not enjoying this. I'm not the right fit for this person. This doesn't work. And we've had that conversation. We've parted ways. You park the agreement that says we're in it for 12 months. You let them out.
Yeah.
Much better.
Yeah. It's just not worth the hassle, right? You know, it's all round, and you're better off parting ways and still shaking hands and getting totally on with life. And then the second thing I always remember you said was, I'm not your therapist. I don't know if that was just me. but I get what you was going, because you said there's a thin, like there was, you said there's a line, right? And said, I'm remembering this right. So you said there's a line. So anything below the line is a coach, and above the line is a therapist, and you probably need to go and have therapy. And some people actually need both, right? I mean, especially people who've had traumas and actually had some pretty tough times in their life, you probably do need both, right? And to I suppose as humans, we all need, you know, different needs at different times. But yeah, so explain to me about the line, the below and the above the line, what you meant by that.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the listener that's listening right now, I want you just to ask yourself, where do I sit? And you might ask yourself this with two filters. One, with your professional filter, like what you do for your career work. And then secondly, ask yourself the same question in your personal life. So you've got this line. Let's just say it's a horizontal line, and we'll call it the line of sanity. Now, below the line, are experiences of anxiety, extreme anxiety, panic attack, depression, suicidal ideation. So down there, a coach cannot help you. And if a coach says, don't worry, I can help you with these different things with your depression, please run a mile. So the only people that can operate down there are licensed therapists, psychotherapists, psychologists. So coaches cannot ever go down there. So that tends to be things that have happened in your past. A coach will spend very little time in the past. Coaching is all based around the model of positive psychology, which is all future focused. So when we get to that line of neutrality or sanity, whatever we want to call it, above the line is hope, excitement, positivity, possibilitarianism. That's where a coach will thrive. And at times you can have both a coach and a psychologist.
Do you think you run the risk of falling into that trap? Because I'll give you a good example. Right? On some of your workshops and the sessions, you go pretty deep, right? You're really deep in terms of your emotional state and, you know, what makes you happy and what makes you unhappy. And I think it's fair to say that some people might walk out and go, crap, I do need a therapist after that session. So what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think for example, at the High Performance Leadership Program, the very first thing we do is look at vision. Because to me, vision precedes victory. If you don't have a clear vision,
That's your seven steps, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So step one is vision.
Yeah. So we get clear on what's my vision for my life, for my career. And for some people, that's very triggering because for some people, they have no clue. For other people, they realize they are so far from where they imagined they wanted to be that it's horrific for them. And so yes, it can actually send them into a state where, ooh, I'm not happy. I'm not happy with how I feel, maybe even how I look, the relationships I'm in, maybe some of my habits. And yeah, some of them will go away going, I need to go and get some therapy to work through some of this stuff.
Sure. And this, the Tony Robbins thing does that as well, right?
100%. Yeah. And that's what it did for me.
Yeah. And it's interesting, there's some commonality coming up in different walks of life. So there's a new program on Netflix called Your Rich Life. I don't know if you've seen this
yet. I've been watching it with Caroline, actually.
We've probably binge watched, I think, six out of the eight.
Isn't that awesome?
It's brilliant. But he talks about what's your rich life, and he gets his journal out, and you have to visualize what your rich life looks like. And as you know, for some people, it might just be going, I can go on holiday or go on vacation without worrying, or I can take the kids for a meal once a week, whatever. You visualize your rich life. So I guess you're probably, it's in tune with that kind of that
100%
mental visualization. Okay, so that's step one. What would be step two?
So then we look at desire. So we can have a clear vision. You know, let's say it's a sports team, they want to win. At the end of the season, they want to lift the cup. That's great. Game one, they go out and they're firing all cylinders. Game three, and the weather's turned and it's 4 degrees and it's sleet sideways. Some of the players aren't quite so motivated. So second pillar is around, okay, what is human motivation? What drives human motivation? How do we individually manage our motivation? And I like to call it desire because I believe motivation, you can go along and have someone like Tony Robbins, who's phenomenal at what he does, motivate you. But 4 weeks later, he's not there. How do you stay on that trajectory? So to me, desire is slow burning, but never ending. It's always there. It's like if there's a parent listening right now, you have so much desire to protect your child. And it doesn't matter if you're tired. If someone tried to hurt them, you'd get up off your ass and you'd protect your child. That's desire. And I think when your vision is so clear and you're passionate enough, that desire comes. You don't need to have Monday motivation. You just get after it.
Yeah. Okay. So that's number two. Number three?
BS. Lee, you've got so much BS running through your head. Now, what I mean...
Thanks, mate.
As Lee asks me to leave. What I mean by that, and the listener, you have BS too. It's your belief systems. So we all have these subconscious belief systems. At one point in time, both you and I likely had the same belief around this guy called Santa Claus. We believed in him. That was a deep seated belief. And we waited for him. We knew December building up for him. But actually, when we got to 9, 10, 11, or for me, maybe 16, and we realized he wasn't real, then all of a sudden we could change our belief like that. And we knew it was mum and dad. Sorry if there's any young listeners right now. But your belief systems, to me, are things that you're in control of. And a belief is simply something that you repeat over and over and over again to the point of time where you believe it. And so that whole pillar, we look at, what are your beliefs about money? What are your beliefs about relationships, success, failure? And then are they serving you or are they not? Are they helping you move towards a life that you're proud of your rich life, your best life, or not. And if they're not helping you, so for some, it's like money scarce. There's not enough money in the world. Money doesn't grow on trees. Is that serving you? Is that encouraging you to step up? Maybe not. Okay, what could you reframe
as? And how do you break those down though? Because I'll give you an example. There's a particular scenario where someone in my life where those beliefs have been deep rooted for probably the last 40 years, right? And it would have been probably because what their parents thought and that kind of thing. So, but those belief systems aren't things you can probably break down super easy. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. Some beliefs more than others, but there's certain things that happen from childhood. And when we look at behavior, human behavior, there's certain things that happen up to the age of 8 that are very subconscious, and the analytical mind is like wide open as a kid. So everything that's going in is just being stored. So if you have a carer or a parent or an uncle saying, money doesn't grow on trees. Look after your pennies, save them up, be careful with your money, store it away for a rainy day. Well, all of a sudden you get into your 30s, that subconscious belief is really deep and you're very protective of that money. Let's say you make a lot of money or something happens, you get a windfall. It's like, oh my God, I better protect this, rather than go, how could I invest this?
Yeah.
So it's sometimes very...
And it's hard, right? Because I can remember my mum saying to me, Lee, and this, you'll laugh at this now. She's like, go and get a job in the post office, son. She went, you'll have a job for life.
I can imagine you in the post office.
One of my mates who's probably listening to the show, he's worked in the post office for, and my dad did as well, for 30 years. And there's a few comments around post and pack, et cetera. But my mum's beliefs were, go and get stability. And that would have probably been drummed into by my grandparents, right? You know, get stability, job for life, and you know, go and get a job at the council, you get a good pension. It's like, and like looking back now, and I think for me, it was like, that would have been my worst nightmare.
I get it. It's interesting. So I think you and I have a similar influence from our parents and grandparents. So like my mum's a civil servant. Her dad was a civil servant. My brother and my sister are civil servants. It's good job, safe job, long-term, good pension, you know? So I certainly think there's a lot of that more protectionist mindset around money.
And it's a tough one because I think your parents are so influential, right? And then you hear all these stories about people who have been trained to be lawyers and accountants because that's what their parents and their parents' parents did. And they actually go, I don't like law. And so that's a big moment in your life if you can actually work that one out, right?
Huge. And I think there's going to be a listener right now that's listening going, I don't enjoy what I do, but I do what I do. And it takes a lot of courage, one, to just become aware of that, but it takes a ton of courage to go, what am I going to do about it? There's a saying in where I'm from in Northern Ireland, in certain circles, your child is going to be doctor, lawyer, or a failure. They're going to be one of those three. And certainly those were not circles I grew up in, but the more affluent circles, doctor, lawyer, failure. And it's interesting, I'm yet to meet many doctors and lawyers who've been in it for 35 years, who are thriving in health, mentally and physically, who don't have some interesting habits. There's very few now, that there are exceptions, but those careers are hard. And they're taxing, and you take your work home with you, and you think about your patients and you think about your clients. So for the person that's listening right now going, I don't really know if I love what I do. Well, get your journal out. Like Lee talks about his journaling. Get your journal out and reflect on what's important. Get clear on it.
Yep. Okay. So that's number three. Number four?
Number four. We're going back to the high performance leadership pillars. Yeah. So self-discipline. So over the years, I've interviewed All Blacks, Prime Ministers, Formula One teams. Now, the one thing they all have in common is this fanatical self-discipline, the ability to do what most people can't. And you would say, James, what they're doing is just common sense. Yeah, it's common sense, but it's not common practice. And so we look at, okay, what does self-discipline look like? What does it require? What are the actions, the tactics that require you? So what time do you get up? What's the first thing you do when you get up? What do you eat? What are you reading? What are you not reading? Who are you hanging out with? Who are you not hanging out with? Where does the self-discipline need to show up physically, mentally, cognitively, professionally? That's pillar four.
Okay. And the reason I'm walking through this, because for me, it's those seven pillars are actually a good starting point for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And if you're looking to improve in aspects of your life, you can actually look at, you know, number one or number six and go, actually, those are two I might focus on. So let's go through them, and then we can talk about, you know, what some people can maybe do thereafter. So that was number, I've lost track now.
Four.
What's number five?
So five is the one that got asked to speak about the most. This is the one that people want to go straight to. Can we shortcut to that one? And that's habits. High-performing habits. People are like, what's the habit? What am I seeing on Instagram? I'm scrolling through and some random channel says, these are the top six habits of Elon Musk, so you must do these. Look, I'm going to say, if you're listening right now, do not run and jump at any old habit. Take your time, figure out what a habit actually is. And habits are very simple. They need three things: a trigger, an actual behavior, and then a release of dopamine. And that's why for many of us, social media is so addictive. Because every time that little ding, that little notification, that's a dopamine release. And so what do? That dopamine release goes off, triggers us to lift our phone. The behavior is scrolling, engaging, then another ding, and then another notification. We're there for sometimes minutes, hours, longer. So it's really important to figure out that's what a habit is. Now, what habits are serving me and what habits are not? So identifying, you know what, those couple of drinks I had, that's fine, but the six I had on Saturday, that's not serving me Sunday morning.
And we touched on, I think, this in a conversation we had probably at the start of the year, but Stolen Focus, so the Yoan Hari book, where he talks about if you're struggling to focus because you're addicted to being online, that's not your fault, because there's a thousand, for every time you say, that's it, I'm coming off of Instagram, I'm coming off of Twitter, there's a thousand engineers whose job it is to make you to stay on there longer. Because if you're staying on there longer, they're starting to get a picture of your habits. They're building that digital voodoo doll of you and kind of what you're into. And so, and then there was a section in the book about says is Facebook and is Echo Dot listening to you? And everyone thinks they are. Everyone puts their hand like, yeah, they are. But actually, it's not, because you've spent so much time online. They've built such a good picture about what you're into, what you're not, what you like, what you dislike.
You're predictable, right? You're
predictable. So those habits, once again, are hard, and especially when you've got Silicon Valley battling you, and you're going to lose every time.
Right? 100%.
Battling you to get you online and spend more time online, because then they can sell more advertising dollars. So I think one of the things you're quite good is be kind to yourself, right? So some of those habits you're not going to change overnight.
No, and I guess the thing I want you to think about is your life. So if you look at your days that you spend, your days are your life in miniature. So whatever you're doing every day compounds and that equates to a nice picture of your life. So your micro habits, your little tiny things you do every day, equate to your macro life. So for the listener right now, I'd like you to just take stock. What are the things I do and eat and say and hang out with? Do I work out? Do I not? And going back to Yoan Hari, so if you haven't listened to that book, listener, please go and get it. It's mind-blowingly good. Yeah,
it's brilliant.
The one study I wanted to share from that was the Hewlett-Packard study, where they got a team of scientists in to study their workforce. So they split the Hewlett-Packard workforce in two. This workforce over here, say workforce A, was told, you're not going to be distracted. There's going to be no phone calls. Nobody's coming into your office. Just you can do your work uninterrupted. Workforce B, you're going to have to deal with what most normal people deal with, which is the odd phone call coming in, maybe some emails that you've got to respond to quickly. People will walk into your office. That sounds like a normal place, right? So scientists come back with the data. Workforce B, who were distracted, their IQ points went down by 10 points, which means it affects their ability to focus, ability to make good decisions, to be intellectually switched on, just in the short term. However, the scientist said this: how would you feel if all of your workforce smoked a joint? That's right, marijuana, before they came to work. Oh, no, we wouldn't allow that. And the scientist said, well, if they smoked marijuana, their IQ points would go down by 5 points. So because you've got distracted workers, they're twice as likely to make poor decisions, be distracted and lose focus continually based upon people who are actually smoking a drug over here. So distraction, chronic distraction, is costing us time, money, everything.
Multitasking is a myth, right?
Agreed. Monotasking is the only thing that we're actually capable of doing well.
Yeah. Okay. And then what's next?
So after that, then we go to evaluation. So I firmly believe self-evaluation is the seed of self-mastery. And here's an interesting one for you Kiwi listeners. There was a recent study done with Kiwis, Canadians, Aussies, and Brits. And across all different spectrums socioeconomically, Kiwis came out as the least likely to be introspective, least likely to read about what they've done and evaluate, least likely to journal. And look, I'm really fortunate, and I would say that a lot of Kiwis I deal with are not like that. They are high performers, and high performers tend to self-evaluate. But that whole section is around getting clear on what does good look like. Doesn't need to be perfect, but what does good look like? Today, did I move towards that or did I move away from that? Give myself a rating, 5 to 10. You know, where do I sit? How did I show up as a dad today? Oh, geez, it's probably a 6. I was a bit distracted. How did I show up for myself today physically? Ooh, that was a 9. You had a good run this morning. So self-evaluation to me is the starting point for you to grow continuously throughout your life and for you to measure really objectively, am I improving or am I in a holding pattern?
Okay. And just touching on that point around the Kiwis being introspective or not being introspective. Mm-hmm. One of the things that came up on the previous show was around the tall poppy syndrome in New Zealand. And yeah, to the point where I actually said, I think it saddens me quite, because anyone that kind of achieves some level of success, they're generally hacked off at the knees by whether it be the press, whether it be their industry peers. And the question I got asked was, is that the same in the UK? And I said, actually, no, it's the opposite. You know, actually, you probably promote it and you put these people on a pedestal and you actually give them a TV show sometimes, right? And so, yes, there's the high performers and rugby and maybe that's the answer, is that most of the high performers are in sports over here or, you know, going beyond. But why do you think tall poppy syndrome is such a thing in New Zealand?
Look, I do see it happen around the world in different places. So the way I think about it, the higher you climb, the sharper the knives. And I recently saw this unfold in Formula One. And Christian Horner's team, Red Bull, obviously turned the tide after Mercedes just absolutely clean slating them for a long time. Now Christian's felt the turn and there's a bit of hatred towards Christian. And so that's obviously not New Zealand, and we can see that happening on a global scale. Look, at the end of the day, you're going to have people who are in the arena fighting the fight. And then you're going to have observers and commentators on the side. The only people worth listening to are the people in the arena, sweating and bleeding. All these keyboard warriors and these heroes on the side. And you know what? For some of you, this could be some of your family members, right? And it's sad to say that, but sometimes it is the people closest to us are who are criticizing when you're successful. You need to ask yourself this, and Lee, this is something I firmly believe in. So many people or like, hey, look, can I just give you a wee bit of constructive criticism? I'm like, yeah, fire ahead. As they're giving me that feedback, all that's going through my head is, have they successfully constructed what they are criticizing? So if it was an event I'd ran and someone's like, hey, can I give you some advice on the event? I'll think, have they built a team or have they ran an event? Yeah, you know what they have? Cool, I'm going to listen to this. If this was my drumming and it was someone on the side going, James, you missed that Rademacher there. Like, that could have been a wee bit. I think, have they won a world solo championship? No, they haven't even tried. Okay, I'm not going to listen to them. So for the person who feels like they're being cut off at the knees, just take a moment and think, the person that's criticizing me or pulling me down, am I going to give them that platform? Have they successfully constructed what they're criticizing?
Yeah, and you're right about the family thing, right? Because a friend of mine's been going through this recently where probably similar upbringing, grew up on a council estate in England and done well for himself and come over here, realises there's a big world out there and built a life for himself. And then he's got, you know, members of his family saying disparaging comments about how he's changed. And I said to him, mate, I'd be saying to you, you're absolutely right. You're 100% right. I've changed. And I've had it, you know, with family, you know, connections of the family saying, you know, you think you're better than everyone else. And I said, well, if going and making a life yourself, providing for your family and being happy, thinks I'm better than everyone else, then so be it, right? And that's okay. But you, as you say, you got to choose, I think what's the term, you choose who you listen to, right?
100%.
Yeah, yeah.
And I
yeah.
think that, like, I mean, that actually leads on to the last pillar, and that's you're either growing or decaying. You're not neutral. You're doing one or the other. And for the people who go on, you've changed. You think you're better than us, they are decaying. I'm sorry to say it, but they are not on an upwards trajectory. And envy can run real deep, and even worse, jealousy. And so you've got to really decide, hey, what trajectory am I on? And who's on that train with me? And sometimes there will be some family and friends, and sometimes they will get off at a station, and you've got to keep moving. But to me, that's critical to identify the people you need on your train to help you continue to grow.
Mm. And we mentioned someone in Christchurch who we both know recently, just before we came on air, and this person is probably like Marmite, right? You know, we've polarized a lot of people, but I think what this person's doing is amazing. I think fair play to him. You know, I think it's great. But once again, that tall poppy syndrome, it's all about brand X, that person. I'm like, well, but that person's working hard and trying to achieve something, right? So yeah. So kudos, right? So to that person. Okay, so that's your seven pillars, and that's the program which you work through with your team and the people that come onto your course. So high performance, how do you know if you're a high performer?
Okay, this is really important. So do you know do you remember Robin Williams?
Yep.
What do you remember about him?
Mrs. Doubtfire, Goodwill Hunting, Good Morning Vietnam, funny man, right?
Funny man, yep. Legendary,
yep.
Right? Sits in our minds as this hilarious, incredible human. Look, many people would say he's a high performer, and they acclaimed him, and they put the pressure on him to continue to perform at that level. But we know that he ended his life. So I want to say that I know that high performance and the definition of it has changed. And that is this. To be a high performer, you've got to perform above the standard norms. So that could be in your industry, that could be with your health, in your relationships, but you've got to perform above the standard norms, the status quo, over the long term. So you win one championship, one world championship, or you win one thing, or you sell one business, that's good. But let's see if you can make a track record of it. That's high performance, not a one-off. So performing above the standard norms over the long term. Here's the vitally important part. And the beautiful Robin Williams, I wish this had been part of his life. This is the bit at the end. Do those things whilst maintaining positive well-being and relationships. So for me, anytime I work with a client one-to-one or with a group, I will not be, hey, let's win at all costs. I don't believe in it. There's too much at stake to win at all costs. Well-being and relationships, that's what gets you through life. That's the elixir of life, is relationships and well-being. So to me, that's the definition of it. Performing by the standard norms over the long term whilst maintaining positive relationships and well-being.
And I guess like someone like myself, you mentioned about being above average in your industry, but I think, you know, we've had these conversations before. It's like, but I'm like, yeah, but that's still not good enough. Yeah. Like, so and I think there's a thing or like a meme on LinkedIn where there's a person looking up a hill going, oh my God, look at this mountain I've got to climb. And they don't realize that if they look behind them, they've probably climbed almost to the top of the mountain, but you only see what's in front of you. Don't see how far you've come. And is that a fairly common trait as well you see in leaders?
Yeah, well, you look at great leaders and they've got an appetite for growth. They've got a desire to be excellent. And that is never ending. The one word that comes to mind is mastery. You know, if you want to master something, you never see an end point. So you look at a golfer. They're never the perfect golfer. They're constantly looking for that edge, that extra bit. They have good days, bad days. Parenting, you and I can chat about that. It's a game of mastery. We will never be the perfect dad, but we will continually try to be better. And to me, that's what high performers do. They look for the gold and trying to be that wee bit better.
Let's talk about podcasting. So you're on the other side of the microphone this time, so must be quite unnerving. So when did you start that journey and why did you decide to be a podcaster?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So I started that journey in January 2020. Now, all of us know that right after that came a very interesting time, being COVID. I started.
So that's quite recently. I had it in my head that you'd been doing it for 5, 6, 7 years.
No. So that's how many it's coming up. 3 years?
Yeah. 3 years, yeah.
So no, that's when I started. January 2020, I remember my first interview, Anthony Trucks, former NFL player from America. Great guy. And the reason I did it was I started to become worried that I would be complacent living in New Zealand. And New Zealand is home. I love New Zealand, but we're a tiny island in the South Pacific, far away from lots of things. And I thought, if I'm going to work with incredible people and add value to those people, I better stay current. I better stay way ahead of the curve. And I've got to talk to the people who are doing the best in every industry. Why are they doing it that way? How are they doing it? What did they learn? So I can bring it back to the people that I serve. And so it was out of curiosity, out of desire to grow, and to make sure that I didn't become a mediocre player. And that would be just staying in New Zealand and being legendary in our own launch boxes, right? And that's easy to do that. I do not want to ever become that person.
I've had a few people already get in touch about podcasting in general. And I think it's like a lot of things is the start of it is quite daunting. Like, which microphones do I pick? We were having a conversation before, right? You know, which pod track do you use? How do you edit? You know, what do you do with the files? How do you get noises out of the background, et cetera? But at the start, you know nothing, right? Yeah. And then you look forward and you've done hundreds of episodes now. How many have you done?
Yeah, coming up, I think 200 something.
200. So it's probably fair to say that the quality of 200 is probably slightly better than the number one. So what were some of the things you learned in the early episodes?
Yeah, so probably a couple of things, Lee. So I think the first things first, you've just got to get started. You've got to take the first step. There's lots of talking in life and often not enough action taking. So for me, it was just like, let's get started. So I got started and it wasn't a very smooth start. My first interview was on Instagram Live and I hadn't really planned for it. I knew that I could record it somehow. And I was lucky that I did record it, but the audio quality was very average. There was lots of blips and cutouts. So I decided, okay, I don't think I can do that. Or maybe I should give it one more try and see if I can improve the Wi-Fi. Anyway, one more try. We're not doing that again. So the key thing was like, hey, that was not successful. I learned a little bit. What do I need? Okay, I need to get a decent mic. I need to do it on Zoom. So I can do it in person here. So I'm going to do it in person. But I need to test their Wi-Fi and my Wi-Fi a week out. I need to test our mics, need to talk to them about not touching the microphone and slamming tables, all these different little things, but it all came from reflection and always going back and listening to the podcast. So I don't like hearing my own voice. I really don't, but it's essential as any kind of interviewer, broadcaster, facilitator to go back and listen and ask, how did I set that up? Did I say?
I've listened to everyone because that was a tip I think you gave. And as you said, I'm not too bad in terms of listening to my own voice, but it was interesting the amount of ers, the arms, the gap fillers.
Yeah.
And so we had Michael Philpott, who was a speaking coach, and that was like another roles reversal because you're speaking to a speaking coach whilst you're speaking. You know, it's a little bit unnerving. But he said that. He said it's exactly that. You just have to listen to yourself, and that's the best coaching he can give you, as well as preparation. So I'm 100 mile an hour motor mouth, as people will probably know. But episode one, probably a little bit different to episode eight, episode nine, where you can calm down, you slow things down. So listening back would have been an early one. Definitely. Anything else? But what about some of the technical aspects of it?
Yeah, so at the start, essentially, I was trying to edit everything myself, and I don't have those skills, but I was trying to develop those skills. And that was ended up being very time consuming. So I was up till midnight, six nights a week, trying to get an episode ready for the week, plus do my job, plus be a dad and try to keep fit. It was just totally overwhelming. So for me, it was like, okay, if I'm serious about this, I've got to really double down and build a team. And so I looked at the stats. I think 3 or 5 is the average what each podcast has in terms of episodes, and they stop after 3 or 5 episodes.
Pod fade, we talked about that.
Pod fade.
Yeah.
I love that term. Yeah. Right? It's a real thing.
Yeah.
Most people start crashing and buying, done. I thought, that's not what I want. I want to be in the game. I believe in it. And I believe there's a big need for quality information and wisdom. And I thought, you know what? I could just run a solo cast and try and be that deliverer of all this wisdom. And I laughed. I thought, no, that's so limited. I've only so much to give and nowhere near the amount of wisdom that people need. So let's find the best people. And so probably the big learning there was get a team to help as the podcast grew, but also be very selective about who comes on as a guest. And I guess when I look back at my guests, they've all been amazing. I've been blown away by them. But as time has went by, I've got a filter through who's the right fit for my listener, because not everyone wants to listen to my show. People who are leaders and high performers, whether it's in sport or in the corporate world, will love my show. Somebody who wants to know about parenting, wrong.
And that's important as well, right, in terms of understanding your niche or your niche, as they say, and you can't be all things to all people. So for you, it was very clear that you was like high performers, leaders, that's my niche.
Definitely.
That's who I'm going to create content for.
Yeah.
Okay. Who's been your favorite guest?
Oh my goodness. Come on, you can't ask me that.
And I knew you was going to push back on that as well, because I've had 200. So come on.
Okay. Let
it
me
might
just.
Be, no, it might not be for obvious reasons. So yeah, who was your favorite?
Okay. I'm going to, I mean, there's been several who have brought me to tears. There have been several who have been brought to tears themselves through some of the questions that I posed. But there was one lady in particular that really challenged me and almost shook up my thinking. So her name's Nabila Ixtabalan. She's a, that she was the CPO, the Chief People Officer at Walmart Canada. So 100,000 associates or employees that she had to care for. At the time of speaking, she was 38 years old, youngest Canadian Muslim to be in that chief executive role of a large, I think, Fortune 100 company. And we got chatting about her life and her experience and what she values as a leader. And DEI came up, the whole idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I was so fascinated by what she had to experience as a young female Muslim and made me appreciate the level of privilege that I have and have had. Even though I've had adversity, I go, wow, it's nothing like what she has experienced. And she asked me this question, and I'm going to ask this, you know, of yourself, Lee, you can have a think about it, but also the listener to have a think about this. Who are the five people outside of your family members? Who are the five people that you hang out with? And think over the last month, who are five people I've spent time with? So Nabila asked me this, and I thought, okay, I've got them in my head. She says, okay, tell me, what kind of cars do they drive? So I kind of started telling her, she says, okay, so they all drive a similar car to you. That's interesting. She said, what color of skin do they have? I was like, goodness, yep, they've all got the same skin color. Okay, what gender are they? And like 65, 70% of them are all male. What age range are they in? And they were within a 10-year age range of me. So I started to get the picture really clearly. And I realized I was living in an echo chamber. I was hanging around with people who I loved hanging out with, but realized they were literally feeding back my same thoughts, like confirmation bias, right? So that challenged me to think I need to be around more diverse people, different genders, different backgrounds, ethnicities, because only those people will help me grow. And if you don't have those people who are different than you around you, they will not see your blind spot. Nobody can see your blind spot if they've got the same blind spot. So that was, she really shifted my thinking. She's now the CEO of Walmart and doing great things. That was a transformational experience, that episode.
Yeah. And I can relate to that slightly in the fact that when I left school, I was pretty keen to get away from the people I grew up with because they had that fixed mindset of we live in this street, we hang out with the same people, we go to the same pubs. And the reason we go there is because our dads and their mums went to those same pubs to hang out with them. And there was, I'm not going to name places, but there was a place I was like, I'm surprised there's actually any change in the gene pool. Because it was also like, you know, so, and that was just the way it was, right? And as you say, it's like the Truman Show it's that kind of approach where people just didn't really realize there was a big world out there. And that was for me, I think even at an early age, I was like, no, I will go and live somewhere else. I'll live overseas and I'll do what I can to get there, right?
But it's that ambition, right?
Yeah, but absolutely agree. And without that diversity, you never change, you never grow.
Totally.
You just have that fixed mindset of this is normality, right?
Definitely.
Okay, so that's a great guess. You then started doing some events a few years ago.
That's right.
And yeah. So I've been to one of these events and I for me, it was fantastic because to get the caliber of people that you get along, I'm going to ask the question how you get them along. But I mean, so you're getting prime ministers, you know, All Blacks coach, you know, someone who's won a World Cup winning coach, and this is all on the same day. So just what goes into preparing for those events and how do you get those people along?
Honestly, in terms of what goes in, people really only see the 2 and a bit days that they're there. And the feedback, I have to say, I'm really proud of the team that I've got wrapped around it. The feedback has been overwhelmingly positive from everybody that's been over the last few years. But the amount of preparation that goes in is colossal because to me, it's my responsibility for each and every soul that turns up to make sure that they get cared for, they get challenged, they get equipped. And when they leave, they've got a different filter of their own world and their own life. So to make sure that that happens, we've got to make sure we have a good program, which is obviously the High Performance Leadership Framework. That has been iterated on and improved. And after every program we run, we're always looking at how do we fine tune it. And to me, that's an essential component, but also the guests. Look, I don't think anybody wants to turn up to an event and be talked at for 2.5 days. They want to be engaged with. So part of my job as facilitator is to engage. The next part of that is to bring along diverse voices who've actually fought in the battlefield. And what I mean by that, like Steve Hansen, great example. Arguably, and I'm sure that it's been written about, world's greatest coach of all time, right? Arguably. Up there with Alex Ferguson. Up there with Coach Wooden. Like, amazing. I know he's going to bring a diverse conversation and incredible wisdom. John Key, former prime minister, whether you voted for him or you didn't, great man.
And I've since found that John Key's like Marmite as well, right?
100%. Yeah.
But you can't argue the fact, you know, his background and what he's achieved and come from fairly humble beginnings. Really? Well, yeah. So once again, for the listeners who aren't aware of these people, so essentially James's events, high performance leadership event, he managed to get World Cup winning All Blacks coach and a former prime minister who, you know, had a decent term on the same event in Little Old Christchurch.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you mentioned before though that those guys are quite keen to pay it back and pay it forward as well, right?
100%. And I think part of what I do is trying to find people who are at a point in their career, their life, where they have something really valuable to give and they actually want to give it. And there's probably a couple of things that are essential there. And I guess if anybody's running an event, you'll understand, but you've got to make sure there's a synergy between you and that individual. So essentially the way I run it, and you'll be familiar with this, is I interview them on stage in front of a live audience, and then we open it up to Q&A.
Yep.
Now, if we didn't have a synergy and we didn't have respect and trust there, those people wouldn't sit on the stage. There's no way, you know, both of those guys are knights, actually. So both, they're both sirs. There's no way they'd put themselves in the position.
I've completely nicked that format, by the way.
So. Have you? Good.
So some of the tech events, you know, and I think it's once again, it's probably a sign of the evolution of presenting and talk. So when it's that kind of chat show host, you actually get the authenticity and you get the true story, you get the and he was quite emotional, right? You know, Steve, you wouldn't have got that if he'd had to do a PowerPoint deck or, you know, 10 slides on what makes a high performance leader. So I think you get that real human element that comes through. But yeah, good format. I think, you know, it's interesting, a couple of the events I've been to recently, they've used the same format as well. Good. And it's definitely more authentic, I think.
100%.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. People know that you've done the thing. So with Steve, with the World Cup, with John as being prime minister and did very well financially prior to that, they know all the things. They don't want to be told, I've done this. They want to be told, this is where I began. These were the moments that I thought I was going to trip over. This is my moment of self-doubt. Here's how I overcame that.
And I think for me, that's probably one of the issues I have humbridge with. When there's quite a lot of events and motivational speakers. And like when it's a former prime minister and a World Cup winning coach, you go, yeah, I'm going to sit and listen to him. But as I say, I'm sure I speak quite for a lot of people. I'm quite underwhelmed sometimes when there's all these people going like on LinkedIn, I'm a speaker, I'm a highly acclaimed speaker. And you go, mate, what have you ever done other than speak at these events, which no one really goes to? So maybe that's just me, and I need to be a bit more open to these things. But yeah, I think I always say to people, like, choose your heroes wisely.
100%. And I think you come back to, you know, what this podcast is all about, time and motion. If you want to go to an event, even if it's a 1-hour event, but if it's a bloody 2.5-day event, you got to do your research and make sure that who you're showing up to is the real deal, that you admire them, that you're in awe of them, because you're never getting that time back.
What would you say your biggest source of motivation is these days?
There's a few things, Lee, that come to mind. The first thing that comes to mind is Finn, my boy. So he's 6, almost about to turn 7.
Going on 21.
Yeah. Yeah, you've met Finn. Bit of a character. I would say, you know, I had this big moment just 8 months before he was born, like, oh my goodness, I better produce everything I'm ever going to produce and get it out and get all the passive income set up, and my life better be perfect, because when he comes along, I'm not going to be able to do anything. I'm going to be so busy. Look, the opposite is true. When he came along, I was more focused on how I used my time, more motivated to be successful. So Finn is a massive intrinsic and extrinsic motivator for me. And you know what? One of my key values is contribution. Like, really thinking, if I'm going to spend time with Lee right now and I'm going to take the valuable time of the listener that's listening now, I'm only going to say yes to that if I feel I can add some value. And if I can't, I don't want to waste anybody's time. So that's a big motivator for me, is knowing that I can add value in some places. And I also am aware there's many places where I can't add value. I'm not going to sit at that table unless I'm there to learn.
What's the big plan, James, for you?
Look, global is important to me. And I firmly believe the world is getting smaller. And I don't want to be ever a big fish in a small pond. I don't think there's much fun or challenge in that. So with the podcast, with the business, a global focus is truly important. So I know Stephen Bartlett might be listening to this. And if he is, I'm coming for you. I'm going to promote his podcast.
That's Diary of a CEO guy, right?
That's it. Diary of a CEO. And I'm proud to promote his podcast. He's my biggest competitor, but he's about 500 miles ahead of me. And I'm coming for
him. He has 70 people working on his show now.
70. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Like, I admire him so deeply.
Yeah.
So for me, Lee, it's getting to that level where I know I can impact millions of people. And that's not about, hey, ego tick. That's like, okay, every minute that I'm spending interviewing or passing on information is valuable for many, many people.
Yeah. And I'm quite conscious of, I'm a fan of his show, but I'm quite conscious of the imposter approach. So you hear this a lot of podcasts. You can see they're absolutely trying to rip off other people's podcasts in their style, they're interviewing the guests. And once again, the previous guest we was talking about podcasting in general, and he mentioned that he started to see a trend in terms of people getting on guests, because I know it's going to up the listeners, but it's the purpose of the pod show is has moved so far away from what they set out to do. And you know, I can see it already, like there's London villains and London gangsters, right? They seem to be like 10 to a dozen at the moment on most of the big podcast that I've subscribed to, which they weren't a year, they're probably more businessy a year ago.
It's trending.
It's probably, they probably know their audience, right? They probably know that they're going to get listeners, which then they can earn some decent money off the advertising revenue, etc. So, but I guess staying true to your core values and your beliefs around what you're trying to do. And like for me, like time and motion, personal productivity, business productivity, you know, stay true. And that's quite broad, but stay true to those beliefs and it should serve you well. But I can see how easy led some people might be by, you know, going after the big thing or the audience attractor.
Totally. And what comes to mind when you say that is stick to your knitting. Know what you do and just go after that. And what's interesting, I'll share with you, Lead on Purpose, my podcast, actually started out as Life on Purpose. It was the Life on Purpose podcast. And what happened, Lee, it was really, really broad. And I didn't really know what my identity was as a show, as a host. And then I started going, okay, what am I passionate about? And that is leadership, because everything rises and falls in leadership. So a year in, I rebranded it Lead on Purpose. And I stick within that wheelhouse. So I've probably say 3 or 4 inbound requests each week saying, hey, James, here's somebody for your show. They've got a book coming out. We'd like them to feature on your show. Would you like to have them on as a guest? 90% of the time, it's a no. And it's not an ego no, like, hey, you've got to be a certain status to be on my show. It's not like that at all. It's not who I am, but you're just not the right fit at this time for my show. It would be a waste of your time and my audience's listening time. So that's important, I think.
Let's talk about leadership then as we come towards the end. I'll be completely honest here. The fact that you was doing high performance leadership coaching rather than just vanilla coaching, leadership coaching, was like, that was me going down the pub going, yeah, I'm doing high performance leadership. None of that, you know, boring, normal leadership. am I the only one that's thinking that? Is that a thing?
Well, I think there's so many different streams of leadership. And to me, there's mediocre leadership. There's traditional leadership. But to me, high performance leadership is very unique. And it's about outperforming.
Do you think people come to you though because of that? They go, I want to be a high performer.
Many. Yes, I do believe so. And here's what I think. No, I'm going to change it. Here's what I know. If people come for something that's been branded as such and they don't get it, it falls apart real quick. So I've seen people in different industries, not just in coaching, brand themselves specifically to attract a specific audience. The audience turns up and they don't get what they paid for. So I think for me, it was like, okay, if I'm going to be really doubling down in this leadership sphere, what is my type of leadership? And to me, it always comes back to high performance. And I just stay in that wheelhouse. So we run the mental skills program with Canterbury Rugby, really passionate about high performance. I stay there and I don't try and stray outside it.
What would you say the top 2 or 3 traits and characteristics that you've seen in those high performance leaders that you've spoken to and gained knowledge of over the years?
Yeah, a couple. Well, the first one is very obvious. That's vision. I'm yet to meet a high performing leader that was vague about where they were headed. They're like, there's where I'm headed. That's what it looks like. And I'll know when I get there because these things will happen.
Yeah. So Steve Hansen was quite clear, right? He said that he wanted the All Blacks to be the number one rugby team in the world for the next 5 years, right?
That's right.
And that was his vision, right? And quite easy to articulate. And I think he mentioned that how many leaders of businesses have actually articulated and shared that vision. Does everyone actually know why we're here? You know, is it putting a man on the moon? That's the first one. What are the other couple?
Relentless pursuit of excellence. You know, again, whether it's an athlete, whether it's a Formula One team leader, whether it's someone running a small organization, or just a really incredible parent, they're relentless on the pursuit of excellence, being better and growing. Yes, they have rest because rest is essential, but they're continuously pursuing, how can I be world class? So that's a trait I've seen.
And the Eddie Hearn audio book, if you're not into books, is called Relentless. Probably the best one I've heard recently. I'd say is well worth a listen to for anyone who wants to gain more knowledge around that one.
I'll check it out.
Yep. And then what's the final one?
You know what? This is a very tactical thing. This is something that I've seen show up, and it's got two strands to it, but these are things that have shown up with probably 90%+ of the hundreds of people that I've interviewed. And the first one is meditation. Meditation is a practice that I see a lot of these high performers engage with. And that could be through breath work. It could be through a long walk in nature. It could be through sitting down, eyes closed, guided meditation. And the other thing is consistent journaling. And journaling's not having a butterfly journal and talking about the clouds. Can be if you want. That's you, Lee, right?
My eyes are rolling. But it's got flowers on the front cover, though, is that right?
I know what you're getting for Christmas. But it's journaling is a practice, and it's about forward movement, and it's about self-evaluation, honesty.
But that can come in different ways, right? So I'm not challenging, because you're not really challenging on it. But like for me, journaling is this now. It's the podcast, and it's updating Facebook and people on LinkedIn. And I've had a bit of stick about people on LinkedIn, on LinkedIn again. But it's actually more for me just articulating and collecting my thoughts for that particular moment in time. And I don't know whether that's still getting the same achievement in terms of maybe writing your thoughts down. But like for me, that's the way I offload, right? And so is that allowed, would you say? Or do you think we still should be writing on a book?
Look, I think any vehicle to express yourself in an empowering way is great. You know, if you're on social media pulling people down and being nasty, well, that's not going to work. Yeah. But I know I've seen your post and I follow you on LinkedIn. I love where you go and what you add. But look, I'll share a bit of the neuroscience behind writing versus typing. So I want you to think right now, Lee, back to primary school and learning the alphabet. So you learned it, you could say it, A, B, C, D. Then teacher says, okay, get your pencils. Today, we're going to learn how to write the letter A. And so you learn how to do it. And then just do another one. And you do hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, right? Why are we doing that? We're building up a skill so that it's automatic. You get it to the point of automaticity. Where is it sitting? It's sitting in your subconscious mind. You've literally inscribed it. Your mind can see the letter A. So when we journal and we write, we're inscribing those thoughts, those learnings, the wisdom right into our subconscious mind. The same does not happen when we type. We did not sit and go A. That there's no connection there. When you write and inscribe, you could be doing it on a digital tablet with a pencil.
I wasn't. I hear you. It's almost like they say the endorphin rush you get when you actually tick off or scrub a to-do list rather than ticking a digital version, right? You don't get half the amount of rush that you totally want. Yeah.
Tonight, before I go to bed, I will get my journal out, and the three things that I said I wanted to do today, I will score through. And one of those was to show up here with you and be fully present and enjoy it. And I know I can go, yes, did that.
And you can cross that off on your paper book.
100%.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So as we bring the session to an end, time and motion is all about business productivity and personal productivity. So what would you say the top two or three things people can do to be more productive?
So the one thing I hear a lot is, hey, Lee, how are you? And often what I hear is this, so busy. I'm busy. Look, people are not busy. If you're listening to this right now and you're saying, I'm a busy person.
Busy fools.
Exactly. Yeah. You simply lack priorities. So to be productive, get your MVP sorted, your most valued priority. What's your MVP this year for personal and professional? Then break it down to this month and then this week and then today. Bring it down to the one thing that's your most valued priority. Yes, you can still have a to-do list, but that's not your priority list. So I think the first thing first is getting clear on your MVP. Planning is a massive part of my life, and it is for you too. You're not going to meet with a podcast guest unplanned. Why? You've wasted your time, theirs, and the listeners. It's not going to be a great show. So Sunday, for me, I sit down for at least an hour on a Sunday and go, okay, what's this year about? What does this month have to be about? Okay, this week, what capacity do I have to execute on that? How much time do I want to spend on these key deliverables? So it might take an hour, and I plan out Monday through Friday, knowing exactly what I'm doing, how it's going to look, gets it on the calendar.
But I think on that one, though, I think it's important to note that people are very different in their approach. So I know for a fact, like Christy, my wife, is so detail oriented. Like she'll ask me to help and she'll read every single word on a page. And she's like, you didn't read that. I was like, I didn't, I scanned. And I'll probably be the same with my preparation. Right. So I know that sometimes my 8, 10, 15 bullet points is going to be enough because I know the conversation is going to be, it's going to get the conversation on the right track, where some people will probably have to type out word for word, letter for letter, every single question. So I guess the question I'm asking there is, it's okay to be, as long as you work, you find what works for you, right?
100%. Yeah. And I think don't kind of prescribe to certain things that are told, this is how you must do it. Everyone's got their own way. But if you find that you're stressed out, you're not hitting your own personal or professional targets, then look at what you're doing and what you're not doing. Refine your process. And there's so many different tools out there, planners and different things, widgets on your phone. You can definitely become better in those areas. But just get clear and just reflect, am I productive? Am I not? Cool. What do I need? Like for some of my podcasts, I'll do a lot of research. But if it's someone I know, then I'll have literally three questions that I've written down. That's it. And I'll let the conversation flow. So some people might look at that and go, wow, you're not thoroughly planned. Yeah, but if you overplan, you don't leave any room for creativity.
Yep. Okay, and then final question, what I ask every single guest, if you could go back and give 21-year-old James some words of advice, what would that be?
Drink a lot less alcohol. That's exactly what I would tell 21-year-old James.
And you've just done 1,000 days of sober, right?
That's right. Just 3 years, just over 1,000 days now. Yeah. And it's been an incredible journey. It was a personal challenge. I would say I'm probably with most people in that I wouldn't have called it a problem. I wouldn't have called it an addiction, but I was on the drinking spectrum, as most of us are. And my partner Caroline said, I'm going to do 1 year no beer, which is a kind of fun challenge that she heard about in a podcast. I laughed. I said, I'm not doing that. That sounds awful. And then the next day I woke up, I said, okay, I like a challenge. Let's do it. However, there's a bottle of gin in the cabinet and half a bottle of wine. Tonight's the last night. And Lee, we went to do it for a year, celebrated the 1 year anniversary, a beautiful restaurant, about to order a bottle of champagne. And something inside me just said, nah, I'll just take a couple of Heineken Zeros. And each year we've just decided on the anniversary, hey, see how it looked.
We've had a chat about this before. And I did 3 months at the start of the year. And it was just, I think it was more for me to say, could I do it? And I think we had this chat. I was like, but James, I actually quite like a drink. But for me, I think doing those 3 months and knowing I could do it. And as you say, it's so easy these days to turn up with some 0% beers and some of the nice ones, right? Yeah. You know, it's a Garage Project and a Beemoff brewery do some nice ones. And I think I said to you, a lot of the time, it's you just need something in your hand to socialize with.
100%.
But I think that's in our DNA. When we talked about the British culture and the Irish culture, and it's, you know, drinking and gambling is probably two vices that have been, as part of the DNA, right? I think definitely. That's changing though, because I think the kids and the younger ones are coming through. Most of them don't drink these days. I think
100%. Yeah, yeah. Well, the science is just so damning.
Yeah.
And you look at the neuroscience behind it as well. And, yeah. I mean, the big thing, Lee, obviously I get, I'm privileged, but there's also a big responsibility that comes with that in that I work with great leaders. I get to speak to large audiences on stages. So I could be up there going, alcohol is evil. Do not drink. I'm never going to do that because I firmly believe everybody knows what relationship they want to have with alcohol.
I think I read one of the Tim Ferriss books and it said something like, 70% of the CEOs of the top companies in America don't drink. They meditate and they exercise daily. I mean, you know, you only need to look at that, the evidence. People that are high performers generally have some common health traits as well.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, James, what's next for you? What does the rest of 2023 hold for James Loughlin?
Some pretty exciting things. So obviously we've got our event coming up in a couple of months here in Christchurch, High Performance Leadership Program. We're also launching Executive Edge, which is a program specifically designed for CEs, chief executives, all at C-suite level, CFOs, really that next level of leadership who are responsible for leading teams. We've got quite a lot of keynotes all around New Zealand and Australia. I really enjoy connecting with large audiences. And then just keeping an eye on that global platform. I've got I can share it with you guys. It's about to launch. It's about to be announced. So I've got a collaboration, and it's really part of that global play with a company called UBOX, UBX, the world's largest boxing platform franchise. So I'm about to collaborate with them. So Loughlin Leadership and UBOX will be in collaboration globally. I'll be their head of high performance. And they're growing at an incredible rate. It's all focused around health and mindset. They've got 100 and something stores opening in Japan. They've got way more than that in Australia already. It's growing significantly. So that's going to take a bit of my focus this year. But again, it really plays into my larger vision of making sure that I stay really on top of things globally.
James, really fascinating talking to you like this. It's actually a bit weird, to be honest, you do it with the headphones and the microphone, but fascinating listening to your story and your experiences of high performance leadership and the people you've encountered and your podcast. Really appreciate you making the time, and I hope you have a good week.
Lee, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers, mate. Take care.
So that's another episode done and dusted. I'm sure you'll agree that was a fascinating listen. James was really open, and I really enjoyed talking to him, as I do all of the guests. Absolutely love doing this show. So as our international listeners go up, I'd love to hear from you if you know anyone that's got a good story to tell that you think our listeners would love to hear about. And you can contact me on email, which is lee@leestevens.co. That's lee@leestevens.co. Or you can use LinkedIn, which is where I am quite a bit. Go on there and send me a message on there, and we'll try and get these people on the show. In the meantime, have a good week.